Well, good morning, brethren. Wonderful to see everyone this morning. Fabulous to have the auditorium full, or it looks like it's pretty close to full. This third day of the Feast of Tabernacles, wonderful time to be with you. Excuse me. You know, now that we have a new administration and a Wall Street that has been bailed out with a couple of trillion dollars of your money, or should I say your children's and your grandchildren's money, we as a nation are now free to obsess once again about our addiction to oil and other things. And we're going to seek to continually try to satisfy that particular craving. In fact, we are so addicted to oil in many ways that we even eat it and we breathe it. And we're literally eating and breathing petroleum. Sometimes we don't realize that. Where does that chemical fertilizer that goes on your food and your fruits and your vegetables come from, do you think? We eat it. We're not only powered by petroleum, but we're fed by it as well. We breathe it. Almost every perfume and spray we have has its foundation in petroleum. You probably don't realize that. That's why so many people have fragrance difficulties. That's why we have a special fragrance free area up in the balcony, as Mr. Dowd was mentioning this morning. We're pretty addicted to oil and to energy as a people. But ours is an addiction not just to oil, but to energy and to what energy produces or what energy creates. That is power. We're power hungry, certainly in business and in industry, but also in the sense of electric power. We're addicted in many ways. And not just for oil, we're power hungry for all kinds of outdated and outmoded and outclassed, down and out forms of power. And we're still plugging into transmission lines that are out of date and grids when the lesson of the scriptures would actually teach us in many ways to go wireless. Let me give you an example. Probably wondering where I'm going with this, but I'm going to take a little time to kind of introduce it. Last year, a major project was completed due to a big increase in traffic in the San Juan Islands, which is a little spur called the Washington State Highway 20 West. It was being transformed, and it used to be a very simple two-lane road, dotted with feed processing plants and great little breakfast diners and picture postcard tulip fields. It's now become a full-throttle, four-lane commuter thoroughfare. The diner was bulldozed. The old-growth firs became bonfires. The local antique store, the convenience store, the bargain motel all disappeared under a layer of asphalt. The local, all of the things that were there, that were beautiful, that were fun, have disappeared. But guess what was resurrected again after the destruction? Ugly telephone poles and wires once again. Got to have our power the old-fashioned way. You know the drill? All the ground gets chewed up. Huge holes and divots get dug. Trenches are troweled open and closed up. But the final act of construction then basically jettisons the whole project back into the 19th century. They put back the telephone poles again and the lines. What century are we living in? Isn't this the 21st century? Don't you think we could find a better way to do power? New wires are carefully reinstalled, big post holes are dug, creosote-soaked poles are sunk, lines are strung up. The technology of the 19th century gets resurrected for a new 21st century project. What about your neighborhood? Are they doing things like that in your neighborhood still? Are they still tearing things out and then putting back old technology and old telephone poles and that kind of thing, and where you live, plugging back into old grids, probably. Any number of obsolete construction and obsolete technology that's going on around us in this society when we could be doing differently. The location of Washington State Highway 20 West is on the way to one of the most northern places in the U.S. West. Fierce Canadian nor'easters come swooping down the Fraser River Valley and slam into the coastal northern area of Washington. It's one big wind tunnel, and during the winter storm season, high winds whip up and down and routinely knock out power lines and take out a transformer here and there. And those power failures wreak havoc on the lives of people in those areas for days and sometimes weeks on end. Yet when given a blank slate and a chance to truly update and upgrade, to safely tuck all those dangerous and drooping transmission lines underground, what do the local governments and the power companies do? They go back to the old way of doing things. Do they take advantage of ongoing excavation and hide those wires from the eyes of people, the eyes of humans, and the eyes of the storm? No, we don't do that. The local power company returns to the scene, digs hundreds more holes, and inserts hundreds more cancer-causing creosote poles, and strings up thousands and thousands of feet of new, maybe we should say old, electric power lines and technology. The power lines are now definitely back on Highway 20. This was done in 1980 or 1990. This was 2008. The project was completed just this last year. We could be living in a wireless world. A much cleaner and a much safer world, so typical of the way the world goes, the way the world does things. And here's one of the biggest problems. Nobody notices. Nobody cares. Nobody observes. Nobody complains about what's going on. No one even registers how ridiculous it is to go backwards instead of forward. Our focus, our finances, our future, we're so caught up in old school ideas, and not just in power, in all kinds of facets of what man is doing, so much based on greed and selfishness. It's so elementary. We should see these kinds of things and do something about them. But do we as a society? No. Humans don't like to change, and thankfully there is coming a time of change, real change. Not change for the worse, or change for the sake of political rhetoric, or change for the sake of change, but real change for the better, something better. I think we know what that time is. It's called the millennium, and we're here as a type and looking toward that millennium. Man simply doesn't know how to govern himself. He doesn't know how to provide for himself on this earth. And I'm just talking about telephone poles. That's just one of thousands of aspects of how man can't govern himself and doesn't do the right things. If we take a time warp into the future, these kinds of problems are going to go away. They're going to be resolved. We're going to have to deal with them and solve them in the millennium of Jesus Christ and his reign. Problems are going to be resolved. They aren't going to be ignored. And the present greedy, cheap, slipshod way of doing things and answering needs isn't going to be allowed anymore. I want to transition here from our sad present state and day, and I want to talk about what the prophet Isaiah said about what's coming in the millennium ahead of us. He was inspired to record a number of things for us that are very interesting to read and kind of look at and contemplate. Isaiah not only tells us about his day, he talks about the future. He foretells the occurrence of similar things in the future as well. We often call them parallels or prophecies or dual prophecies talking about events that happen now, but also happen in the future. And he talks about many of those things. Let's first take a look at a couple of primary verses here. I want to turn over to Isaiah chapter 30 to begin. Isaiah chapter 30, I'm going to begin in verse 18. This is a very powerful section, and I think it describes a great deal about what you and I will have to do in the millennium. Isaiah 30, verse 18. And therefore will the Lord wait, that he may be gracious unto you, and therefore will he be exalted, that he may have mercy upon you. For the Lord is a God of judgment. Blessed are they that wait for him. And certainly we are in the process of waiting. This world is indeed desperately waiting, and it doesn't know what it's waiting for. But we know what we're waiting for: the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of his government on this earth. Verse 19, for the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious unto you at the voice of your cry. When he shall hear it, he will answer. You know, the people in the future living around Jerusalem and in the beginning of the millennium, they're going to have suffered a great deal. They're going to have been through many, many trials and tests and problems. They're going to be waiting for someone to help them. Teachers, people who will be needed desperately to re-educate, to help them learn to conceivably deal with a lot of the problems that they've encountered and the problems that they now have facing life in a brand new society. I used a simple example of power poles on Highway 20 in the Northwest, but there are so many things that are going to need to be changed in the millennium. Hundreds of things, and I don't have time to cover them all in this sermon, and I'd like to touch on a lot of things. What will it be like to be those teachers? Verse 20. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not your teachers be removed into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers. We're going to be around to help and to assist. And your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it, when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left. What's it going to be like to be the teachers who will give that word behind people? On opening night, Mr. Black talked about what it would be like to be a king and a priest. Well, here's some of the things that kings and priests are going to do. We're going to be involved with people. We're going to be preparing to give a word behind people when they need it, when they need to hear it. We've often looked at these verses and thought, well, you know, this is a correction. This is an opportunity to correct people. A one-on-one confrontation with individuals who are headed in the wrong direction or about to sin, and that we as sons of God are going to be catching and preventing and talking with them about that and steering them in the right direction. And certainly that does apply. But you also have to realize these people have been through a tremendous amount of correction, as Mr. Myers mentioned yesterday, through the Great Tribulation. What they need now is encouragement. They need wisdom. They need advice. They need counsel. They need all of those things, not necessarily correction. The word behind them may have all kinds of meaning, all kinds of help that they are desperately in need of and should be. You know, over the years I've been corrected by people sometimes that are right in my face, slam, almost a fist in the mouth type of correction. But I've also been corrected by people whom, when they got done, I really didn't know I'd been corrected until I thought about it a little bit later. And realized, and I guess I thought I came up with a correction and thought, well, you know, I really ought to change that. Have you ever been corrected by somebody you didn't even know you'd been corrected until later? They were so smooth and so diplomatic and so careful and so uplifting that you didn't know you'd been corrected? Can you correct somebody like that? You're going to have to do that one of these days. And I think we need to be learning how to do that now. How to correct somebody else so they don't even know they've been corrected. That takes talent. That takes a skill I don't yet have. And I don't think many of us probably yet have. I think about that and I realize, boy, what's it going to be like to be a teacher in the millennium? Certainly we'll be sons of God, be spirit beings, hopefully, able to correct. But I don't think we're going to know everything, and I don't think every word of correction that we may offer will be precisely what's exactly needed at the moment. We may have to learn how to do that. We may have to develop that skill. And I think if we get an early start on it now, it'll be a lot easier when we are children of God to give correction to people. We look at that and I think, boy, there's all kinds of words behind them that could be offered that people will need. Have you ever thought about the manufacturer or the CEO of the company that's introducing a new product? Or maybe a power company that's about to string up new power lines. You may have to offer a word behind them. Some suggested that we don't need to do things that way now. You know, there are better ways of doing things. The product might be good, but they might have to, in order to produce that product, they might have to dump all kinds of pollution into rivers or into the air or into the ground in order to produce their product. Maybe we'll have such a thing as a new product review council of individuals to take a look at things before they're produced, before they begin polluting, before they begin dumping things, or before they introduce a product that isn't a benefit or isn't a real benefit or maybe is made too cheaply and then it breaks and isn't worth the money that people spend on it, as so many things are today. Or maybe a new design council to help them get through the manufacturing process without polluting and to design things economically without being cheap. Will it give you as much pleasure to have a word behind someone to prevent those kinds of pollution, those kinds of bad products from being introduced, as it will me? I bet you can think of a few words to offer to a few companies that you know of, or a few individuals or whatever today. We need to learn how to do that so that, in a way, they don't even know they've been corrected. We'll be able to do that in the future. If you happen to be the newly made son of God who taps this man on the shoulder and says, you know, your product, it's a nice product, but you have to dump stuff in the river in order to make it. We don't do that here anymore. I mean, there's probably more diplomatic ways of saying it, but and I'm hoping to figure what they are out between now and then. But we're going to have to talk with people. We're going to have to provide a word behind them in the future. Maybe you've learned about manufacturing processes, or maybe you were a product engineer in this lifetime, and maybe that's why God called you, because maybe you have something to add in that area, in the millennium in particular. Ever wondered why God called you? Ever wondered about the experiences you had in life? Why were you called? Well, to become sons of God, certainly, but you're going to have jobs. You're going to have work to do in the millennium. People to interface with, people to teach, people to talk to, people to offer a word behind them when they need it. a lot of these things, you know, I thought about these things. You could be in marketing, you could be a sales representative, you could be in all kinds of areas, and there may be big needs for people who are familiar with those things and able to do those things in the millennium. Most of us don't know why God called us right now. We're doing our best to be the example, to be the light that Mr. Myers mentioned yesterday that we should be in this society, but we may not know for sure why God picked us out, what our future is, other than becoming a child of God and a son of God. That's wonderful, and that's a great future. But what are you going to be doing with that? I don't think we're going to be sitting around. Obviously, we'll have things to do. Jesus Christ will have things for each of us to do. Perhaps you're needed on the new product council. Maybe you need to work in a certain area because there are so many areas that need to be corrected and fixed and worked with, and so many people who need to be directed in the right direction. Maybe you know how products are designed. Maybe you brought them to market in this lifetime and you understand the process and know how to guide people that are doing that in the millennium. Or maybe on the design council. Think about it. I want you to reflect a little bit about what are you going to do during the millennium. Isaiah talks about a number of things that are going to change, a number of things that are going to be different in the millennium. I'll get to those in just a minute. But in terms of the experiences that you've had to help prepare you to help a physical people during the millennium, what are you going to say in your word behind them? Will you have the wisdom to be able to correct? Maybe so that they don't know they've been corrected. How about building bridges? Again, there's a need for people in this lifetime who have learned how to build things, who learn how to, you know, how to deal with stresses and loads and how to build things properly so that there's no danger. You may have to make suggestions to engineers and companies of the future on how they do things, to prevent pollution, to prevent hazards, to prevent bridge collapse because there were cheap components or bad construction habits. Who knows? The steel making process and the aluminum making process today are quite polluting along the way. I think we should be able to make steel and make aluminum without those kinds of things. I don't know just how to do that just yet. Some of you might. But in the millennium, we're going to unlearn a lot of the things that we've learned to do the wrong way and show people how to unlearn what they've learned to do the wrong way with a word behind them. The prophet Isaiah tells us a great deal about the millennium. Let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 1. I'm going to go through a few chapters and hit just a few verses here and there in Isaiah. Chapter 1, verse 21. Chapter 1 and verse 21. How is the faithful city become a harlot? It was full of judgment, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross, your wine mixed with water. It's kind of an interesting way, colorful way that Isaiah talks about this. And here we're seeing basically the moral decay of Jerusalem before the millennium begins. And in verse 22, we're seeing some things here, both literally and figuratively. The silver, kind of a reference here to the prized teachers of a decaying society. They're like silver without the dross removed, unpurified. The great moral principles and the teachings of God's word today have been diluted with man's ideas and with his philosophies and certainly the teachings of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Corrupted. Verse 23, your princes are rebellious and companions of thieves. Every one loves gifts and follows after rewards. They judge not the fatherless, neither doth the cause of the widow come unto them. The leaders of society have corrupted themselves, and they're rebellious against authority, but particularly against God and all that God stands for. We, as a society, have thrown him out of everything that we do. And we see in verse 24, the bringing of a time of tribulation upon man. Then once people are yielded, once people are brought to a time of repentance and the tribulation is over with, then people are going to be yielded. They're going to be ready to listen. They're ready to hear the word behind them, so to speak. And once people reach that point, they're going to come under the tutelage of Jesus Christ and you and me. You ready for that? Think about those things a little bit. And being the children of God, what kind of advice will you have to offer? What kind of words will you have that they can hear behind them? Verse 25, "And I will turn my hand upon you and purify and purge away your dross and take away all your tin." You often wonder what's that talking about. The King James here is a little heavy. Talks about tin. It's a little confusing, the Hebrew here for dross, coming off the silver in the smelting or the purification process is really a type of lead, but it happens that in Hebrew the word for lead and tin are the same, and so they're used here. It's referring to the dross that's coming off. God taking away their tin is really taking away the dross in a figurative sense of purifying his people and purifying their leadership and the city of Jerusalem. That's what he's talking about doing here. Verse 26, "And I will restore your judges as at the first, and your counselors as at the beginning. Afterward you shall be called the city of the city of righteousness, the faithful city." In the purification, God is going to restore their judges and their teachers, at first with spiritual children of God, those changed at the resurrection into the spirit-born children of God. And they're going to provide that word behind people that they will need to hear along the way, and we're going to teach their human leadership to become good judges too, and good leaders and good counselors and good advisors, with a word behind them, at least until Jerusalem is full of physical leaders and counselors who can teach others God's way of life as in the millennium, or as the millennium progresses. Verse 27 says, talks about the eventuality of the cities of the world becoming the same way here in a very colorful way. Verse 27, "Zion shall be redeemed with judgment and her converts with righteousness." Colorful, encouraging words about the millennium. And we see the famous passages here in chapter 2, beginning in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 2 of Isaiah. And he says, "It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come, come you, let us go up to the house," or up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, "and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." There's going to be a word behind and words in front of an awful lot of people they'll need to hear. And we see the earth beginning to blossom with the knowledge of God. God's way being taught first in Jerusalem and then expanding out from there. Isaiah 14, verse 1. Isaiah has so much to say about this time. Isaiah 14, verse 1. "For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob, and will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land. And the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob." All these strangers, all these Gentiles who've enslaved modern Israel in the past are going to be joined with Israel. And they'll stick with the house of Jacob. And it'll be obvious that God is blessing the house of Jacob. And with enough words behind them, Israel will be setting a good example to the world or begin setting a good example to the world, so that the world and the Gentile nations will come to see and come to Israel to learn how to live God's way of life. Verse 2, "And the people shall take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and handmaids, and they shall take them captives, whose captives they were, and they shall rule over their oppressors." In a way, it kind of looks like Israel's taking captives here, among them those who had held them captive before. But what we're probably seeing here is Israel actually making indentured servants out of these Gentiles, the way Israel was instructed to do by God and by Moses, under his servant Moses. It was a six-year process of service in which the master was to teach and instruct the servant on how to live and how to earn a living, and then released in the seventh year. And in this case, I think we're seeing the instruction of how to walk the Christian life and how to earn a living in a new society, a new trade or skill. And the Israelite who's now had several words behind him or her is going to pass those same words on to their servants as they need them and as they need to hear them. And once freed after their 7 years, these Gentiles and others from other nations are going to return to their own lands. And what do you think they're going to offer to the people that they know from their lands? A word behind them on how they learned to live in Israel. And it'll be obligatory for every servant holder in Israel to pass on the skills of living, but also to pass on the skills of worshiping the true God to other nationalities. Verse 7, "The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing." Now, when on earth has the earth all broken forth in singing? When was the last time you heard the whole earth singing? I don't think we have we? We're talking about the future. The whole earth is at rest. The whole world is breaking forth into song because of the joy of having peace and being at rest. When has that ever been true? Never before the reign of Jesus Christ. Verse 8. Yes, the fir trees rejoice at you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, "Since you are laid down, no feller is come up against us." Again, they aren't going to be cutting down fir trees or any other kind of tree to make telephone poles, I can tell you that for sure. Natural resources and natural beauty aren't going to be squandered and aren't going to be wasted for the sake of greed anymore. In chapter 25, let's go over to chapter 25 of Isaiah. I could spend all day in Isaiah. I don't think you have all day, but I'll try to keep it short. Isaiah 25 and verse 6. Oh, lights are falling on me here. Put that back up here, I guess. It was stuck on here and it's not sticking. Okay. Well, now it's gone out too. Okay. There we go. That's because I pressed the button. We'll let it sit up there for a minute. Isaiah 25, let's look at verse 6 here. "And in the mountain, or and in this mountain, shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined." That's a verse we've read many, many times during the Feast of Tabernacles. I've tried to avoid reading some of these verses in Isaiah because so many people do read them every year. I decided last year I'm going to be the one to read them this year. I want to. It's interesting to look at this verse. We've often read these and discussed things in a physical way and looked at these physical blessings and the rejoicing and the aspects of the Feast of Tabernacles that reflect this time ahead of spiritual rejoicing. But there's a figurative and a spiritual side to this verse that is just as important as the physical side of it. Sometimes we've focused on the physical side. Mountain and mountains are figurative of governments throughout the Bible. And here we're seeing the mountain or the government of God, the Lord of hosts, is going to be established, and it's going to make the spiritual Feast of Tabernacles a tremendous blessing to people, not just physically in food, but symbolic of the significance of teaching people all of God's way, significant of preaching his way of life to people and reaching people with his way. His food, his gospel message are going to lead the whole world into rejoicing and into fat living, so to speak, or rewarding lives, lives full of joy because of what they're learning, because of the way they're beginning to live. The spiritual meaning of the feast days is spiritual food. And God is going to share that spiritual food of the Spirit and the bread of life with Israel first, and then ultimately with all peoples during the millennium, starting first in Jerusalem. The seed of modern Israel, keeping the feasts, will share this spiritual food with others, sometimes with a word behind them. To their manservants, to their maidservants from other nations living with them, they're going to learn, and then they're going to leave and go back to their nations and teach their peoples what they learned in Israel from God's people. And this feast we're keeping is symbolic too, not just physical. We're preaching and we are teaching a successful life of God's ways to other people now, today, and in the future. A light, as Mr. Myers mentioned yesterday. That's what we ought to be. That ought to be our example. The first Feast of Tabernacles in the millennium is going to be a huge proclamation and a witness to people, to the world, of God's way of life, what he wants for human beings, what his plan is all about. Verse 7 of chapter 25 here. And he will destroy in his mountain the face of the covering cast over all people and the veil that is spread over all nations. That's kind of interesting. Verse 7 is very significant. By this government, Christ is going to destroy the face of the covering veil or the spiritual blindness that is covering the people of this world. They're going to begin to see for the first time. They're going to have their eyes open. They're going to have the opportunity to have God's Spirit offered to them to begin to learn. And they're going to begin to learn from God and from us in that process as teachers in the millennium. How to live, how to walk God's way of life. The ones we teach with a word behind them are going to teach others with a word behind them, and on until the earth is filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. We've all read that before. Let's go over to Isaiah 27, verse 6. There's so many things here in Isaiah, I hardly know which one to cover and which one not to. Isaiah 27, verse 6. He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. The seed of Jacob are going to take root. People aren't going to be moving all around anymore. They'll remain in one place. I've moved so many times during the course of my lifetime, I can't even number them. It's costly. It pollutes. It causes confusion. It damages relationships, and it certainly doesn't help your children to be moving as much as we do in our society. People won't have to move in the millennium like they do today. They'll be able to stay in one place. They'll be able to put down roots and stay in one place. There's so many verses here I want to cover. I'm going to have to skip a couple here and go on. Let's go to Isaiah 32. Let's do that one. Isaiah 32, verse 15. Until the Spirit be poured out upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. Kind of an interesting verse here. It talks about what's going to begin to happen when the Spirit of God is poured out in the millennium and is offered. Verse 16. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and the righteousness remain in the fruitful field. And the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. Quietness and assurance. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Wow. Eventually, we're not going to have to travel all over the place. Jerusalem, we can travel up to Jerusalem and get good judgment. You won't have to go all the way to Jerusalem to get wisdom, to get good judgment, to get someone to offer that word behind you that you need. You won't have to go all that way to go up there. We're going to find quietness and the effect of righteousness and assurance and safety and the result of righteous living locally. All around us, as people begin to learn, as the word comes out from Jerusalem to isolated areas all around the world, begins to develop in local communities, because there will be sons of God everywhere, offering wisdom and teaching. Peaceable habitations. Sure don't have those today. We live in a world filled with pollution of every kind, and sometimes we don't think about noise pollution, but it's there just as badly as anything else in our cities. Let's go over to Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33, verse 20. Look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation. A quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Won't have to take it down and put it back up somewhere else, and take it down and put it back up somewhere else as it moves around and around. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be moved, neither shall any of the cords thereof ever be broken. You won't have to pick up your tent and move all the time from place to place. Jerusalem, the chief city of the world, will be a quiet habitation. Almost everywhere we have ever lived, we have had noisy neighbors. I don't know about you. Everywhere we've lived. You know, either them or their dogs or their rock bands in their garage or whatever. You name it. We're going to have a quiet habitation in the future. Quiet places to live. Speaks of not moving the stakes thereof. You're not going to have to keep pulling up stakes and moving, as they say, from place to place over and over again. Israel, having been in captivity and carried away where they did not want to go, they aren't going to have to move anymore. They're going to be established. Ever noticed how much construction there is going on all the time around us? Building more and more buildings, more and more roads. Well, it's due to several reasons, I'm sure. I have a couple of ideas about why. First of all, of course, there's the lowest bidder. Roads have to be repaired a year or so after the lowest bidder has done their job. We got to rip them up, tear them up, and fix them again right away, because we can't build any quality into anything, can we? That may be one part of it, the lowest bidder. Cheap construction habits, I think we can do away with that. Secondly, of course, people are moving here and there at a frantic rate in our society because we're a mobile society. Everybody's got to go here and go there to get business, to, you know, can transact business. I don't think we're going to have to move quite that much in the millennium. Things aren't going to have to travel so much. Ever notice all the noise pollution that goes with that travel and that movement and that construction in our society? There's a lot of it. We're going to see peace. We're going to see quiet in the millennium. We won't build what's cheap. When we build things, they'll be built for keeps. They'll work right. And they'll be there for permanent use. And people won't have to move frantically from place to place to seek jobs like they do now in our society, due to accommodate greed and selfishness, people aren't going to have to go seeking jobs from place to place continuously. If you know something about construction, about road building, you're going to be undoubtedly involved in offering a word behind a lot of people in road building and construction. Let's go over to Isaiah 35. Isaiah 35. Let's begin in verse 1. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, and the excellency of Carmel and Sharon, and they shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. The Hebrew here talks about the rose or whatever. I think it's really probably a little bit closer to a narcissus. But we get the idea. Fruitfulness, beauty. That's not what we think about when we think about deserts and wilderness. But that's what's going, the deserts and the wilderness are going to be changed. So that we're going to see beauty in them. There's more than just physical and literal analogy here for us, though. The earth is a wasteland after the Great Tribulation. Spiritually, certainly, it is a wasteland in the millennium, too, not just physically. The knowledge of God will be virtually unknown when the millennium starts. There's going to be a lot of opportunity for you to offer a word behind people of how to live, how to walk, how to make things, how to deal with their lives. Verses 5 and 6 here. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert. It's not just physical thirst being quenched here. It's the quenching of man's inner need for contact with his God that's going to be quenched. Spiritual education, the waters of life, the Spirit of God being offered to man the way he really needs it. Verse 7, and the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty springs of water. In the habitation of dragons there shall there where each lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes, and an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools shall not enter therein. Kind of interesting when we look through those verses. Verses 8 and 9. And a highway shall be there. I read that. Verse 9. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up there on. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. And they shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sorrowing shall flee away. There's going to be a highway of learning. A highway of learning through God's Holy Spirit. Not just a literal highway, but also a highway of learning God's way of life. Going up to Jerusalem is a way of life. A way of learning. The devil isn't going to prevent people from going up and learning and have their eyes open to the truth anymore. He isn't going to be around. Spiritually speaking, this highway is a spiritual thoroughfare of learning. And people will come to Jerusalem on this highway to learn about Jesus Christ and his way of life. You and I, brethren, are going to be part of that highway of learning that goes up to Jerusalem as we share a word behind them for those who need it. What words are you going to have to share? You ever thought about that? What do you have to share with those people? like you to think about that a little bit. What will you have to share with these people? Words from the experiences in your life, from the education you've experienced, from your jobs, from your work, from your school. All those things you may find come in very handy. Most of us are learning words to share with others later. We're maybe learning how to share things today, but we're going to be learning how to share things later, too, with others. And how to do it in a new society, in the millennium, under Christ's guidance and rulership. I wonder if we thought about, you know, very much about the physical advice that we will have for physical people in the millennium. What will you have to share? Maybe you work in water management. Maybe you work in forestry. There's all kinds of areas, and Isaiah talks about a number of them. We could go there, but I'm running out of time. Let's go over to Isaiah 41. Isaiah 41, verse 17. Isaiah 41, verse 17 and 18. When the poor and the needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. And I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys, and I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. Right after the tribulation ends and Jesus Christ is returned, there's going to be a need. There's going to be a lot of hungry and thirsty people, both physically and spiritually. And so he's going to create streams in the hills and the mountains and the valleys, pools of water in the wilderness, and springs for the thirsty. But in many ways, spiritually, you and I, brethren, are going to be those springs, those fountains, those pools and those springs in terms of spiritual drink, in terms of education, in terms of offering a word behind them. What about if you work in forestry? Chapter 41. Chapter 41, verse 19. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar and the shittim tree and the myrtle and the oil tree, and I will set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together. This isn't just talking. He mentions a number of trees here, and they're sometimes in very old-fashioned words. The oil tree is probably a wild olive tree, but you know, the others I'm not entirely sure of. But God basically names seven different kinds of trees here. Why? Well, certain aspect of completeness of the fact that he is repopulating the world with trees. There's going to be plenty of trees planted by God everywhere so that we have all the telephone poles we need. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously not. We're not going to be cutting down trees for telephone poles anymore. If you work in finance today, perhaps you can offer some words about not spending more than you make to people in the future, incurring debt. Think we'll have hedge funds in the millennium, or derivatives, or risky financial activity. Seems like a lot of people need to hear a word behind them in the financial arena, don't they? If you work in that area, they have some things to offer, to suggest, some changes to be made regarding people taking up debt and risk and obligation. There's a lot we could have to offer. There's so many areas we could talk about. Isaiah 11, let's go backwards now. Isaiah 11, verse 9. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 9. We've read this many times in the past. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Not just talking about war here. There's going to be no hurting. There's going to be no destruction. No damaging to others. in Christ's rule. There won't be pollution. There won't be exhaust fumes to breathe. There won't be radiation waste. There won't be chemical waste. There won't be CO2 or too much CO2 in the air or nitrous compounds in the air. Insecticides won't be needed. They won't be stored in the fat cells in your body anymore. Anyone who attempts to make or design such things or creates them as a byproduct, I'm sure, is going to hear a word behind them. There's going to be pure air to breathe everywhere, clean and rich soil to plant and to grow abundant crops. And you won't have to go to the grocery store and pay extra for organically grown food. It'll all be that way. Verse 10 of chapter 11. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse which shall stand for an ensign to the people. I'm sorry, I got the wrong chapter here. I think I flipped pages. That's right. 11, verse 10, sorry. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. How about that? A glorious rest. Do you need to use a little rest in the society in which you live today? Indeed, the millennium is going to be a time of rest. It's going to be glorious. It's difficult to describe all of the things that Isaiah talks about in the future here. All the things that are going to be coming as part of this millennium that we're looking forward to. There's certainly going to be a need for a lot of words behind them. Have you thought about the words that you have to offer? The experiences you've had? The life that you've lived? The things that you've learned? Can you share those with other people? Can you share them in a diplomatic way? I always admire individuals who can correct me and I don't even know I've been corrected. That's a fabulous talent. Can you do that? What about you? Are you learning all that you should be learning in your job, in your school, in your neighborhood, in the experiences that you have in life? Are you learning all that you should be learning so that you will have words to offer behind them that they need so badly? Because of what you've experienced and what you've learned, you can share those things with them. You can help them when they need it very badly, especially in the beginning of the millennium. Will it be because you learned the lessons you should have learned in this lifetime now that you're going to be able to share those things with them when they need them? Or are you the person today who maybe needs a word behind them today? Like me. The word behind them, or the word behind me that I hear frequently, is from my wife. She points things out, lets me know when I've missed the mark. Think about where your skills will be useful in the millennium. What are you learning today that's going to be good advice for other people that they're going to need to hear in the future? What part will you be able to play in a word behind them?